This hour, we'll take your phone calls with Keith Thompson. He's looking for stories about your near-death experiences, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Keith Thompson. Keith, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they had their act together, didn't they?
They really did, and it's that one branch of Buddhism that really understood and made that commitment to explore this thin line, this porous space between what we call living and what we call dying. I don't minimize death. I've sat with many dying people. The body does die. The person associated with that body dies. We have photographs of them. We miss them. And we also know from the other side of this that life continues. I think there's really only with the transition that death is and the crisis that it represents for the body and the mind associated with that body, there's just two different forms of life in such fullness. So, the Tibetans understood the preparation process is so profound, and I think there are ways that we all can do what the philosophers have said, live with death on our shoulder, understand that it's always close, and that can be not a morbid thought, but an empowering thought to live this life fully in as many of the dimensions that we can, to practice for the entry into even more dimensions when you get beyond the outskirts of the place that I and other ND people, we get to the outskirts where the death is not complete. That's by definition. We come back. But we come back with a vision of something that we spend a long time trying to integrate. I call it getting served. It's like a spiritual subpoena, a near-death experience. And, you know, they hit you. You know, they say, you're served, the person with the documents. Well, there's no going back from a near-death experience. There's only opening the papers and seeing what's next for you.
All right, let's go to the phones. As promised, let's start with David in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the show. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
Excuse me if I sound a little dense on this subject, but I think your guest might have already touched on this about his near-death experience. If I had one, and I thought I was in heaven, I'd never come back here.
You wouldn't? Why not?
Think of all the people you could talk to. Einstein, Marie Curie, Elvis, Frank Sinatra. I'd never come back here.
Assuming Elvis is up there, right?
I don't know whether it's up or out or where it is, but I didn't get the opera. I didn't get any buddy offering me tickets to those kind of contacts when I was there. I'm not making fun of you because I didn't have those kind of incentives, and I didn't see any of them, but I sure understand the appeal.
Absolutely. And hey, thanks, David. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, let's go to Brian in Stanwood, Washington. Welcome to the show. Hi, Brian.
Hey. Hi, George. Hi, Keith.
Hi there.
Excellent show. My near-death experience, I crashed a dirt bike over in eastern Washington. It was a desert race, and it was a really bad accident. I survived. But when I think I was going through, it's so hard to explain, but when you talk about, like, your life flashing in front of your eyes, it seemed like it was like like the old Rolodex of everything that from when I was born to that accident that day, I could see my whole life flash in front of me. So that's what I have to say today. Thank you.
Well, I can just say that was very similar for me as well. And how has been your efforts to integrate what you experienced in your day-to-day life? Can you talk about that a bit?
He hung up, but
oh, he's gone.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the life review process is stunning. The comprehensiveness of it, and it's right up to the moment. As he said, it's right up to the crash. And we can do life review at any point in our lives. That's what's beautiful. You don't have to have a close encounter with dying. Life review is possible any day. I work with some of my clients that way. They want to do the life review that they've heard about. But we can do. We can review our lives any day profitably, because it's always good to take stock.
Indeed, indeed. Jeremy in Jamestown, North Dakota, welcome to the show. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, George and Keith.
Hi.
Hey, Jeremy.
I have a question. Does your length of your coma indicate anything?
I'm just reading about that tonight, about that subject. It turns out that the period of time that you're out doesn't really seem to correlate with the depth of the experience. Are you saying that you had a coma, in a coma?
He was in a coma for a long time, Keith.
On December 8th, over 2003, over 17 years ago, I was in a coma from a tragic car accident, and I was in the coma for 3.5 months.
Long time, Keith.
Yeah, that's a long time. And did you have people, it sounds like you must have had people near you. Did you have any of these kinds of experiences that we've been talking about tonight?
I was, what I assume was a dream in my coma. I was walking up a mountain trail with the person who was my wife at the time. And we came across on the trail a bunch of falling boulders, and I found a crevice to push her into, and I got knocked off the cliff by a boulder. And as I was falling down, I heard a voice from the sky say, "Jeremy, your tasks are not done yet." And then I woke up in the hospital bed.
Wow. Wow. That sense of that you've got, that your tasks are not done, is very common. And people often come back with a strong sense of a mission or something to do, but it's not clear what it is. And so that's what a big part of a strong sense of coming back was that it's important that there's something to do. And I think years later, I'm doing the next phase of that now. I'm on this program. There have been other expressions of ways that I'm meeting my calling. But that sense of calling doesn't necessarily reveal itself instantaneously. It's lived into. So it sounds like you are continuing to explore your experience nicely.
When you're having a near-death experience, Keith, do you realize that that's what it is?
I was clear. I was clear that I had died. I was clear that I was dying. And I even had a moment. I write in my book, which is of course not yet published, but recently writing, and there was a moment when I said, "Death is not death." There's a practical joke. I said that. I was aware of the humor of that. It's not. There are moments that are not without humor. But yeah, I was aware that I was going to die. That I am dying. And I said, I may be dead. I thought I was dead, and whatever that meant was peaceful, serene, even joyous, and the sense of a release into a larger dimension is not easy to describe.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good. Keith, yeah, I wanted to ask you concerning, because you mentioned earlier that the dead are very close to you. You mentioned your grandparents and your babysitter. Can you access them at will?
No, I can't. What I do is, in fact, I've just recently, since working on my book and opening to dying and death in a new way again, in a way, and it's actually quite peaceful, and it's coming like a nice flow. I have found some photographs of my parents that I've put back on the mantle, and I'm not doing any particular rituals, but I talk to them, and I have my family babysitter found a photograph that's in a frame and put it up, And I speak to them, and I say, how are you? And I happen to live alone right now with a beautiful dog and in the country, so it's very conducive. So the answer is no, I don't actively try, and I don't get obvious. I'm not succeeding or failing, I guess is a good way to do it. But I do believe the presence is near, and that, and I have had dreams recently of my mom that I think might be visitations, for example. So pay attention to your dreams. Pay attention to what we could call synchronicities and things that seem to happen. And also, you know, I don't know if you live in the city or in nature, but pay attention to animals, birds that come by. This whole thing is so vast and interconnected that messengers don't often take the forms that we expect.
Jim is with us now in Tyler, Texas. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Keith.
Morning.
Hey, Jim.
Keith, I had a question regarding your near-death experience, and I guess from the people you've spoken with. When you were in the realm beyond this life and before you were allowed to return, was there any sense of judgment or any kind of shame, especially facing family and loved ones for choices you had made or hadn't made in life?
I want to just absolutely emphasize, no, there was not. And I don't draw any theological implications from that. But the life review, there was a sense of seeing so clearly how I had impacted people for better and worse and how they had impacted me. And I was aware of the absence of shame, judgment, but recognition was there, how I had caused harm and how they'd caused harm to me, and how this process of holding grudges or feeling shame is such an illusory thing. I had this very strong sense, this is none of this, nothing that we think is hidden. In reality, it's not in this realm where we think we can hide, like, oh, I don't want anyone to know how I'm feeling. Well, they do know. Everybody knows everything, and then we have little defenses that pretend not to. What I can say is, from if I were to extrapolate from my own life review process, there is a just total acceptance and freedom from judgment, but the sense of consequences and I felt regret, but no shame for what I had done to someone, lying or cheating. And they likewise held me not responsible because nothing is taken personally.
Keith, other than the strange electrical anomalies when you came back, did anything else happen to you? Were you psychic or telepathic or anything like that?
There's a greater sense of clairvoyance, and I have had in the immediate aftermath, there were times when I would have a dream of walking down a street. I had a lot of deja vus that were, I mean, I have had a dream that included a scene walking down a street and turning to the left and seeing not necessarily someone I know, but a person dressed in a particular outfit that was distinguished. And I would walk out of a building from a meeting I'd been to, and I'd walk down the street and I'd say, this is exactly what I dreamed about. This is exactly the scene. And turn the corner, and there's that person.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of those. They were like residue and aftermath. It was the psyche of this body processing and releasing. The whole process of integrating for me has ultimately been about allowing whatever surfaces to surface and allowing it to be.
West of the Rockies, Matt is with us in Rancho Cordova, California. Hello, Matt.
Yes. Hi, George. How are you tonight?
Fine. Hope you are, too.
Good. So I was just calling to say that interesting show. I'm a longtime listener. I grew up in New Mexico. I grew up listening to your show with my dad. Obviously high activity with UFOs and aliens in that
huge
area.
But that's great.
Anyway, I was calling because, it's interesting about near-death experiences. I fell out of a car when I was six. A horrible accident. My mom accidentally ran over me during a snowstorm.
Oh, geez.
Broke my arm, went to the hospital. I don't really consider that a near-death experience, but George, I've come close a lot of my times in my life to where I've experienced near-death, where, you know, I've had terrible accidents and I've had to go to the emergency room or the hospital. And in one of the cases, when I was in the military, I was stationed at Fort Benning in 99. And when I first got there, we were on a cleanup detail. It's summertime. It's hot. We finished early, and the sergeant in charge, you know, decided, hey, let's go have a swim in the Chattahoochee River. So we decided to go swimming as a squad, and we went down there. And one of the guys didn't really know how to swim real well, and you know, everybody else was like, we'll wait at the bottom for you. Jump in. We'll make sure you don't drown. You know. So he jumped in, but the problem was is the current carried him out into the middle of the river, and the people that were down there waiting for him, they, you know, they got tired treading water, so I had to jump in and try to save this guy drowning. And so I jumped in, and we were swimming to shore, and he didn't really know how to swim, and he's thrashing around, and he's kind of, you know how it is when you're trying to, I don't know if you've
ever
somebody drowning
or
you've heard of stories of people drowning, they struggle. And he's kind of trying to pull me under with him. And we finally some guys with the boat came, and they were able to get us out of the water. But anyway, I mean, it was so close. Like, I looked up, and I could see us going underwater, and I could feel my breath leaving my body. And I just thought, oh, God, am I going to make it out of this? And I just started praying. And then, you know, all of a sudden, we were out of the water, and we were okay. And any time I've experienced any strife or struggle in my life, you know, I was raised Catholic. I've prayed, and there always seems to be some kind of energy or force surrounding me that is there to protect me in any bad situation that I've ever been in. And I want to say that I've been lucky, but I don't really consider it luck. I think it has more to do with my faith and my belief in a greater power. And I just wanted to share those experiences with you. And based on the subject of what we're talking about, you know, is there obviously from what your guest is saying that there is a power like that exists. And I find that comforting in my faith. And, you know, so when people ask me, you know, why do you believe in God? I think that's one of the most powerful things, is that there is a good driving force on this earth that is driving humans to do good things. And it's finding that calling and that reasoning in life to do it. My life hasn't been easy. It's been really hard, but I've found solace in helping other people who are in trouble or going through hard times and need a hand. You know what I mean? And that's what I've dedicated my life to, is helping out other veterans, helping out homeless. Just if I see people, I kind of have a sense they're struggling, and I'll go out of my way to stop my day and say, hey, are you okay? You need something? Can I help you out? What's going on? You
know? That's pretty remarkable. Keith, you do that too.
I do. And I want to say, Matt, feel free to go to my website, thompson@large.com. Send me an email just to get in touch with me. You have just described a complete cycle. You may not have had you may not have come close to death, but a near-death experience can be based on the fear of impending death. And also, near-death experiences very often happen to people who are, I know this isn't what you were describing, but even in deep depression with life, they're in a state of clinical depression that is so deep that all of this stuff is triggered. So it is close to death, closeness to death, a sense of the closeness of death, sense that danger is impending.
Hold on, so, Keith. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment. On our next Coast to Coast program, Dr. Judith Orloff joins us to talk about how to survive in these strange times. And then our investigative reporter, Cheryl Jones, joins us, followed by Open Lines with Cheryl on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Keith Thompson with us. We've been talking about his near-death experience. He's working on a new book called Coming Ashore to a Larger Earth, all about this. And then we'll get final calls here in a second. Keith, you also have a book called Angels and Aliens that was very well reviewed. That's always been a great theory, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it's been the book is out of print, but what's interesting is again, partly from appearing on your show in June to talk about the Pentagon's report that came out, and hopefully there'll be a follow-up. I think we're due for one soon. I have a publisher who wants to put that book back in print with a new introduction to bring it up to speed on developments that have happened since the book was published. So it's a remarkable phenomenon, and there's a convergence. You know, one thing that people describe in the UFO world, those who've had close encounters, including abductions or what are generally they're called experiences now, experiencers have these interactions, they very often will see in the rooms with these humanoid figures, aliens, so to speak, they will often see deceased persons that they recognize. So there's some overlap between the UFO field doesn't talk about it much, but the realm of angels and aliens and the departed may all be closer to one another than we understand.
All right, let's go to final calls. Joe, Monterey, California. Joseph, take it away.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure thing, Joe.
I work with the other side quite a bit, and there's a being that I had asked to have a near-death experience, and I was told that I don't have to have that, just continue to meditate, do certain types of meditation, and I'll have out-of-body experiences. I'll be having these experiences in these higher worlds. In time, I will transform like everyone does when they have a near-death experience or even contact with extraterrestrials as well, like George just put it, that there is a it's a tie. There's a connection there. Do you find that, because I know you contact people, do you find that there is a transition between, let's say, people who are on a spiritual path and having experiences to the same degree of near-death? Near-death is really, really powerful. It's in your face right away. It's a traumatic experience, but it does happen.
Yeah, it is. And I would emphasize again that you don't have to, by any means, have to nearly die to have to come to terms and to come to these recognitions. There's some who would describe the kind of spirituality, the kind of whole, the experience of an unbroken wholeness that the near-death experience points to is what some people in spiritual circles today would call a non-dual spiritual experience, the sense of non-duality, the sense that there are not two dimensions or there's not more than one, a radical wholeness, seamless, unbroken spaciousness. So you might consider teachers that are approaching this subject of non-duality.
I like that. Okay, next up, truck driving in Bakersfield, California. Curtis is with us west of the Rockies. Kurt, go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Morning,
sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about my near-death experience. I had kidney cancer 4 years ago, went in for surgery, supposed to be a very routine robotic surgery to cut the cancer off my kidney. Well, the robot broke down mid-surgery.
Oh, no.
More medicine. I wound up not waking up. I went in surgery at 7 o'clock in the morning, woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning to my mom shaking my foot, telling me to come back. Well, that time I crossed over, I guess, and talked to my grandfather. My grandfather was standing there smoking a cigarette, had a flannel shirt on, sleeves rolled up like always, and asked me what I was doing here. So I don't know. I don't understand where I'm at. And he goes, well, you're not supposed to be here, son. You need to go back. Your time's not up. You're not supposed to be here. And I kept asking. I'm like, I don't understand, Grandpa. I don't understand. And he told me, well, you need to go back. He goes, tell your mama that I love her. Tell her that she made the right choice. I was not coming back. And you need to go back to take care of her. And there's other people you need to take care of. Well, I had no clue. Woke up to my mom shaking my foot and sat up straight in bed, talked to the doctors, looked at my mom. So I just talked to Grandpa right now and told them everything that happened. And the doctors, the look on my mom's face, everybody was just truly amazed at what I had told them. It was the greatest experience I've ever had in my life. Totally the better.
I'll say you were served a spiritual subpoena for sure, and your job is to love your mom. That's exactly what your instructions are, and in that you will transform the world. I trust me on that. You have marching orders, and from that you'll be of service to others in a way that you don't even imagine yet.
Why do our dearly departed, Keith, show up at the moment of what could be death?
Well, there is a strong... my mother was in a coma, and my father died in a sudden accident. My mother was in a coma, so I don't know what she was experiencing, but it is very common for people who are still lucid to say things like, "Oh, look who's all come. What a party. Oh, there's Grandma. There's..." You know, so the deathbed phenomenon is very strong. When Thomas Edison was dying, he kept saying, "Oh, it's so beautiful there. It is so beautiful there." So that it comes slowly. In fact, there's a branch of near-death studies that talks about the up to 2 weeks in advance of dying. Even someone who is well and has no sense of impending death will get signals that are later recognized by others that death was coming. So it raises questions about, we act as if we have free will, and we have to act as if we have free will. And there may be a level of the way in which this is all bound to unfold in ways that we don't understand.
Didn't Steve Jobs, Apple computer, when he was dying, his last words were, "Oh, wow, oh, wow"?
Exactly. I was thinking of him as well. For all his struggles with that cancer, he saw something beautiful. And those, I remember growing up, this babysitter who was our family babysitter, she talked about so-and-so had died and had seen heaven. She kept saying, "Keith, he saw heaven before he died. He knew where he was going." And I didn't, you know, I was a kid, I didn't make much of it, but I'll never forget that. He saw heaven before he died. She was a devout Christian.
Next up, let's go to John in Honolulu. Hey, John, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Keith. I just wanted to talk about a time I was in the Navy, and I pulled into Catania, Italy, and I went snowboarding on Mount Etna, and I accidentally fell off a cliff.
Oh,
and it
God.
Was about a 100-foot cliff, and landed on my head.
Oh.
And I cracked my skull, and it actually, a piece of the volcanic rock embedded itself in my skull. And I had blacked out at the bottom of the mountain where I'd landed, and a couple of my friends that were snowboarding with me met me at the bottom, were able to lift me up and drag me to the bottom. And when I came to at the bottom of the mountain, I woke up, and I kind of found myself in this kind of haze, and I'd lost a lot of blood, obviously, but and I was continuing to lose a lot of blood,
yeah.
But the rock was still embedded. And
the rock probably saved your life.
It was, yeah.
From
so
bleeding
it
to
stayed
that.
There, but I eventually lost probably about 4 liters of blood, which was probably about the maximum I think a human can lose without dying.
Exactly.
And I just remember at the bottom of the ski hill there, just seeing a bright white light at the medic station. And while they were trying to clean me up before the helicopter picked me up, like just seeing this glowing white light and just feeling a sense of like calmness come about me. And just feeling totally calm and okay with the sense of dying, and I was totally at peace with it, and thank God I didn't eventually die, but I just remember that glow, that white, so the whole room was like white and glowing.
Illuminated. Does everybody see that, Keith?
Oh, the white light is a very common experience. The beauty of it, the brightness, it's not blinding. Actually, the tunnel that we sort of think of in the stereotypical sense is a relatively uncommon. that there's often a sense of going through a black or dark field before the white light. And it turns out the tunnel is more of a Western, American, European phenomenon than Asian or South American. And I will say that there is a universal, this is a universal phenomenon. Atheists, and also, as you probably know, George, the blind, lifelong yeah. blinded people report experiences of sight that should not be possible, because in some cases the blinding is life, the blindedness is lifelong, and in fact it's related to the fact that their optical nerve never developed. So when they're out of the body and away from the body, the consciousness sees things that are right in front of them, like a person who is sighted.
Fantastic. Next up, let's go to Robert in San Antonio, Texas. First-time caller. Hey, Rob, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you so much for being there.
Thank you.
Hey, Robert.
I've died three times or had NDNEs three times. One of them was a white light tunnel experience, and the farther I went down, the better it felt, and the faster I went. Then they resuscitated me. I was like, you know, they pulled me back. I was, like, angry.
You liked staying, huh?
And then another time I was riding on a bicycle. This was May 2000 in San Antonio. I got ran over. I don't remember it. I was on a bicycle. I woke up 5 days later in Brooke Army Medical Center in the trauma unit in a coma. And I had a fractured skull and a broken ankle. And I had this dream experience somewhere in the process of, like, descending and to, like, some kind of a river and crossing this river. And there was, like, this check-in desk, and some kind of not very friendly person there said, "No, you can't come in. You got to go back." And so, you know, I didn't go. And so, but after I was back to consciousness and all that, once again, I was like kind of angry that they
pulled
brought me back. But
well, let's check with you on this, Keith. Why is there anger when you come back? I guess there's so much bliss on the other side, huh?
Yeah, it is a very... one of the early researchers of the near-death phenomenon was a surgeon or a medical doctor of some kind who absolutely was a materialist and did not, would never have heard of such a thing. And someone came back from surgery, from being resuscitated, and actually complained right there, "Why did you bring me back? I had gone to heaven," or something along those lines. And the doctor said, "Well, that's nonsense. You couldn't have." And this it's the doctor Pim van Lommel in Holland. In any case, he's become one of the leading researchers, and many of the best researchers have gotten in touch with this phenomenon precisely because they have angry patients who wake up and who did not like the resuscitation effort.
Does anybody ever go to the other side in a near-death experience? Hell?
Does anyone ever completely go? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or pop into hell and check it out?
Hell. Yes, I didn't hear the last word. Yes, there are so-called negative experiences, and they are the minority, but they are difficult. It's not known. It's of course a lot that's not known. But it's what's not clear is some believe, yes, I've been to hell. I went to hell and back. There are some books, I think, to that effect. And there's another view that says, no, it's more the resistance to the and the fear that gets associated, that would be like maybe going on you'll take a psychedelic in order to have a good experience. But if you come at it from fear, the fear will be amplified.
That could be indeed. Keith, we are out of time. Keep in touch with us. Let us know when the new book is done. Like to get you back. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.